I'm Brian. I'm serving drinks and barbecue at Smoke Daddy in Wicker Park, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Good morning and welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is fantastic to be here with you today for show number 895. What we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. And as usual, we say good morning to Bob Ferguson, who is our engineer today in the WGN radio studio. And again, I am happy to be here with you. Looking forward to the show today. Well, tis the season, am I right? We're getting into the holiday spirit with spring-like weather this week. And in the spirit of giving, it looks like area record stores are being targeted by robbers. Did you hear about this? It seems that at least four record stores have been burglarized in the last month. Reckless Records in Wicker Park, Rattleback Records in Andersonville, Meteor Gem in Avondale, and Loud Pizza Records up in Highland Park. So far, nobody is in custody. It seems that a man and woman couple are the ones who are the perpetrators, according to store surveillance footage. And get this, an employee at Reckless even got maced. Oh, this is terrible. I'm not a criminal mastermind here, so I wonder where these records go after they're stolen. I would imagine they're sold on the black market, but I'm wondering how this even works. Meteor Gem is a record store on Elston in Chicago that specializes in rare metal albums. Block Club Chicago reported this week that the store lost about $10,000 in stolen merchandise. The owner of the store, Mikhail Fedyukov, is quoted in this piece, and he's wondering the same thing I am. He says, quote, "They committed a felony break-in in the middle of the night to get a batch of stuff which is large, heavy, and going to be hard to get rid of. If you're going to be doing this much work, you might as well go get a job instead," end quote. That's what I'm saying. If you're a criminal, do you take these metal records and expect there's going to be a long line of buyers on the black market for them? And look, no disrespect to the metal genre, but what is the demand for records like the Blood Runs Cold album, or the Battle Ruins Glorious Dead LP, or the Gates of Hell 12-inch? Sure, these bands have their fans, and that is great. I love it. If you want to rock out to metal, more power to you. But even metal fans will admit that this stuff is pretty niche. Maybe there is a demand for this kind of music on the black market. I don't know. What I do know is that record stores are wonderful places to celebrate all kinds of music. They're special places, and let's support them during this holiday season, because after all, they are local businesses and members of our community are going there, patronizing these stores, and are running these stores. Oh, and during this holiday season, let's get some snow while we're at it, huh? On the show this week, we learn how one local news outlet has severed ties with Google. Wow. And we dive into a very special Secret History of Chicago Music segment, going international this time. Tis the season, am I right? As we continue to live out our high-tech future here, one of the tech giants these days is Google. Google is everywhere. Growing beyond the internet search engine it once was to impacting advertising, artificial intelligence, and our individual privacy. The McKinley Park News is a locally based news service covering the McKinley Park neighborhood in Chicago, online at mckinleypark.news. Recently, this organization announced that it is severing its relationship with Google. to tell us why Justin Kerr is here. He is the publisher of the McKinley Park News. Justin, welcome back to Outside the Loop.
Oh, well, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
You are quite welcome. So previously, you and I on this show have talked about AI and its impact on local journalism, but here we are talking about Google, and there's some AI stuff that's factored in here, but just to talk about why you're doing this, you basically have four reasons that you published on your site, and just briefly, I want to go through them here. You say that Google profits from knowingly publishing misinformation that puts working journalists in harm's way. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, Google, I think, kind of hides behind the section of the law that prevents or that allows it to kind of publish anything at once and enable anything at once without any liability. Yet they're still responsible for maintaining the content of their services, especially services like YouTube. YouTube recently made a decision to allow 2020 election misinformation back on their platform. And for me, this was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back that made it really urgent for me to get off of Google and away from Google. You know, it had been on my list for some time, but, you know, I look at this sort of thing and I see this giant company deliberately choosing to allow information that the company knows is wrong. And then journalists have to go out on the street and deal with the fallout of this misinformation, especially in our current climate where everything's so violent, where everything's so polarized, where journalists are getting attacked up and down on the street everywhere. You know, I find this really irresponsible and unacceptable. And of course, it's highly profitable too, because all of this misinformation breeds controversy and clicks and views. And, you know, there's got to be some level of responsibility both for Google and then also for the people who choose to work with Google. I mean, we as journalists, I can't work with a company that is doing things that might endanger me or my people when they go out on the street, my correspondents and my reporters. Mm. As journalists, I feel like we have a duty to truth. And I feel like companies like Google have absolutely no duty to truth. And there's a fundamental ethical problem with that. And I think it's beyond the point of just, you know, misinformation. It's putting people in danger, putting journalists in danger. And I can't work with that.
So you also say that Google endangers the privacy and security of the readers of the McKinley Park News because of the integration of its services. And I said that there's a privacy issue here in the beginning of this conversation, but specifically, what do you mean here when you're talking about this privacy and security issue around Google?
So Google provides all different sorts of free services and pieces of internet infrastructure that people can pick up and use. And they're quote unquote free, but there really is a price to using it. There's a price for users to use the Chrome browser. There's a price for websites to integrate Google services like Google Analytics or reCAPTCHA. And that's, you know, the privacy of your users or the person who's using these products. Google makes all of its money or the bulk of its money on advertising. And it's not straightforward advertising. It's surveillance based advertising. Google hoovers up everything that it can about end users and then leverages it into our unregulated data marketplace for who knows what purpose. And, you know, as a news publisher, I serve my readers. You know, I want to serve news to people, not my product isn't serving people into a surveillance algorithm. And so I really feel like your news should not spy on you. And, you know, acting in the best interest of your readers, you know, you should have their privacy in mind and not just feed them into exploitation to a company like Google.
And we've seen this. I mean, if you've been on a website or you've even gone somewhere or Googled something, all of a sudden you get the ads on your phone and on your browser. And so,
yeah,
this is all connected. You also say that there's a competition piece here because you don't want to rely on or assist, as you say, an unfair competitor like Google. I mean, really, and I've talked about journalism, specifically this issue, Google is kind of really taking in all of this revenue, this ad revenue that traditionally has gone elsewhere, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's what one of the things that I find very distressing is no one in the powers that be in the journalism institutions are really talking about this. The fact that our money is gone because Google took our revenue. You know, Google is a 9,000-pound gorilla in the online advertising market space. Advertising is the lifeblood of journalism. It's the way that we have mostly, you know, made our money. And most of that money has now gone to Google and, you know, their advertising systems, kind of taking away from what we offer. You know, because Google is so huge, it is able to leverage its position in very unfair and anti-competitive ways. And in fact, as I noted in my little write-up, the U.S. Justice Department has multiple lawsuits against Google, including their anti-competitive practices in the online advertising marketplace. There's all sorts of interesting discovery coming out about this, including how advertisers are getting shafted by this. Like Google apparently made a secret decision to raise advertising prices 5 or 10% across the board for everybody, which it could do because it's a monopoly. And, you know, this doesn't serve advertisers. It doesn't serve the news media or publications, and it doesn't serve the public at all. And, you know, because they're a direct competitor, I don't want to either rely on them or enable them, or I don't want to give them any of my money or give them anything that we do to give them an advantage that they can then use against us. And so that's a primary business reason. You know, you don't help your competitors.
Right. Well, and you also say here, tying it back to the artificial intelligence that we mentioned a little while ago, and you and I have talked about before here on this program, Google is, you know, selling this AI stuff and pushing this AI approach. And as you have told me before, I mean, this is basically stealing your content and then distributing it, and it's taken away from what you do at McKinley Park News.
Absolutely. I mean, these AI services, these companies, and this includes Google, which has asserted a right to basically steal everything that they want from the internet to use in their for-profit services. They go out, they steal our content and they steal our expertise, and then they turn around and put it into AI-based services that compete directly against us, but they use our expertise and content to provide the answers you know, that have a halfway decent chance of making sense. You know, any McKinley Park answer is probably going to refer to the McKinley Park News or the content they've stolen from us, because nobody else reports on McKinley Park. There's very interesting new research that just came out last week, too, where security researchers were able to get AI services to show that they have entire passages and huge chunks of verbatim copies of their training data inside their databases or in their large language models. And this, you know, they've always denied this, and they've always said, oh no, we're not stealing, we're not copying things. But guess what? Yes, they are. This is just beyond the pale theft, you know, and Google is one of the entities participating in this. You know, I know Google's delayed some elements of its AI rollout, but they're really, you know, kind of showing that they're not on the side of news by just stealing from us. You know, we should be able to license our fantastically high quality content as really valuable AI training data. But right now it's just all being stolen from us. And, you know, I don't want to work with a thief. In business, you never work with a thief, no matter how big they are.
So, okay, we're talking about you severing the relationship between Google and McKinley Park News. So maybe someone's hearing this and they're saying, oh boy, I mean, I've got Gmail, I have the Google search engine, I've got all kinds of Google apps. So what does that look like? How difficult was this for you to do in practice?
So As I mentioned, I had been thinking about and kind of planning for this for a long time. Our website has both back-end sort of infrastructure features that had relied upon Google, things like Google Analytics to measure our web traffic, and email, you know, it's using Gmail to kind of collect email accounts together and answer, use it as an email interface. And then there were also front-end, like, user-facing features like Google Maps, which we were using to show local locations and all sorts of information. So I had to break it down piece by piece by piece and kind of find each infecting piece of Google technology or things that I was using. And I'm still tracking some things down. It's still impossible to totally get away from Google, because some sources of news, for example, we have event listings where bands will provide a video and it's only on YouTube. So we embed the YouTube video. You know, we still have some elements like that, but all of the surveillance stuff is gone. And then we also, as a pro-privacy publication, recommend that users download and install a script blocker in their web browsers, which is a great way to protect yourself from Google and any other hostile entities that are trying to spy on you.
So really, I mean, it's doable, but it might take some work. And if you're hearing this, and again, you're thinking to yourself, I don't know, I just get on my email and I just kind of go around. I don't know how to do this. You know, it's not like the average consumer who maybe is a casual emailer, web surfer, really knows this. So that's kind of like, it's almost like the insidious part. It's like, we don't know that we're infected, but we're always being watched, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, those Justice Department lawsuits have been showing and illustrating the billions of dollars that Google is paying to companies like companies like Apple to ensure that they still continue to surveil us or able to surveil us. You know, it was kind of like, I'm either going to stop and take care of this necessary business thing now, or I'm going to just keep let it rolling and it's going to be a bigger mess down the road. And so I decided to pull the plug. We were doing some other work on our website at the same time, and it made sense. And like I said, this past summer, you know, the YouTube's decision to allow 2020 election misinformation was really the, you know, straw that broke the camel's back, or made me say, okay, this is ridiculous. This has to happen soon and has to be a priority. And it's working. You know, we've said goodbye to Google, but we've still got all the same services that Google offers, except we're running them ourselves. They're open source for the most part. They respect end users' privacy, which is a priority for us. And it's very doable. You know, there's some technical elements. As far as your question about consumers, you know, I think consumers, you can do a lot by not using Chrome, which will always phone home to Google and report on kind of what's going on. Mm-hmm. You can use a privacy-respecting browser like Brave or Firefox. And then you can also embed like ad blockers and script blockers within your web browser. The problem, though, is that Google just announced, or they're just starting to disable that capability in Chrome. So if you're using a Chrome web browser, your ability to block ads and control the scripts that are delivered to you are purposely denuded by Google so that they can, you know, deliver more ads and surveil more people.
I want to go back to the journalism industry here. So your website, McKinleyPark.news, is a local news outlet. You're covering block by block in McKinley Park. You're covering the community. You, in your piece here that you wrote up on your website, you put out a call to the journalism industry as a whole, saying that this is really an ethics issue and outlets, local news outlets, should treat it as such. And you say this, you say that journalism institutions like this are led by those more interested in punching their meal tickets than supporting our industry, grasping for more dangled Google News Initiative payoff money, scrabbling to the top of the AI exploitation pyramid before all the jobs are gone, and ignoring the fundamental journalism ethics that make news valuable. Those are your words. So
yep.
You need to, according to what I'm seeing here, how I'm taking this is the journalism industry needs to wake up to this and make a stand.
Yeah, and I mean, I think part of the problem is the journalism industry, quote unquote, and the institutions of journalism are led by those who are not journalists. They're led by those who are academics. They're led by experts. They're led by consultants. But they're no longer actually have like real working journalists, you know, who are tied to the industry running it. And their interests are a lot different than ours. You know, an academic, or those, you know, at these institutions, you know, they have a vested interest in seeing AI work because they get to write papers about AI and they get to talk about how it's like the new hot technical thing that will allow them to succeed in their careers. But no one is considering how harmful this is to the news industry. No one's even talking about it or bringing it up. You know, it's inconceivable to me that this incredibly toxic thing and this amazingly toxic behavior just flies, you know, over the radar. You know, I see the same thing at the Medill School of Journalism. You know, I'm incredibly disappointed that the Medill School is no longer an accredited school of journalism. And I don't know if you know this or your listeners know this, but I think it was at least 10 years ago they lost their accreditation. And then I don't think they deserve to be accredited as a school of journalism, because I've been involved in their programs, and I've been involved in both their, you know, their Metro Media Lab, Medill, the news incubator, but then also on the other side, where they're doing their marketing work and their PR work, and you know, they're training skilled liars. You know, this is about as far away from the idea of journalism as it gets, that we have a duty to truth. And then a lot of people are saying things like, oh, nobody trusts the news anymore. Nobody trusts journalists. Why? What is the, you know, what's going on here? Why is this? And I'm like, well, look to these institutions that are not representing the journalism industry, that aren't, you know, being led by journalists or being or listening to journalists and working news publishers, and instead are engaged in this insanely toxic behavior that harms our industry so profoundly. I mean, how could you trust the news if you can't trust me otherwise? And, you know, there it's, I kind of find Medill becoming sort of the journalism school equivalent of advertorial. You know, it's got this journalism shiny wrapper around the lies of the marketing message. And, you know, I can't see how they were able to justify that to themselves. And I think there's a lot of lying that's going on within the journalism industry. People who are lying to themselves about what's going on and what's happening in our industry and who we should listen to and who are the experts. And, you know, I'm incredibly disappointed at the current state of things. And it's not just Medill, that I've also seen this in Lion Publishers. We're a member of it, and as a member, I've advocated that they be a lot more transparent with their funding, especially as it ties into Google News Initiative. I mention in the column this program called Google News Initiative, which is a for-profit arm of Google just throwing tremendous amounts of money around into the journalism industry. And although I don't know of any examples of specific tit for tat, like, okay, we won't teach advertising because you're paying this us this money, I see it as a pernicious influence. You know, everybody's taking all of this money from Google. No one's saying, wow, is this a good person or a good entity to take this money from? And what will we be pressured to do, maybe? Or what will we might we feel we're pressured to do? How does this create a conflict of interest or a seeming conflict of interest? I mean, it's tremendous. And again, at those levels and in these institutions, no one is talking about this stuff. Nobody's talking about any real issues about the industry, you know, how we got to our sorry state of affairs, how we get back. And so, you know, it's frustrating. You know, that's frustrating too. I don't feel represented by these groups that say they're supposed to represent local news.
It's something I've noticed too about local universities and, as you say, journalism schools teaching this stuff, the conflation of public relations and journalism. And I'm not trying to dump on PR here, but, you know, those are separate things. And it seems like as the years have gone on, they're treated as the in the same kind of category. And I'm thinking about this like, no, actually, these are two very separate things. Why are we conflating them?
Yeah, they share some skill sets, but they are totally different purposes. You know, journalists have a duty to truth or do the best job we can. Truth is our product. In marketing, you know, their job is manipulating perception. And if any truth comes of it, that might be a happy circumstance. I can't see how any of this is squared up. I can't. I'm gobsmacked that no one talks about this within these institutions or in or at SPJ, the Headline Club, or anything like that in Chicago's journalism community. So, you know, there's kind of like, and I feel like there's like kind of two tiers of, you know, journalism going on in Chicago. There's sort of like this benighted, foundation-led, fancy journalism. And then there's the dirty, you know, down in the trenches, you know, guts of stuff, which I feel like we're doing. And then I look at publications like, for example, CWB Chicago, which also, you know, I know it's got its warts, but no one in the journalism industry in Chicago talks about them, despite them being an incredible journalism success story in my mind. I mean, the guy's making money. He is doing journalism that moves the needle in terms of the quality. I've never seen anything that's factually incorrect in it. And I know they've been a little bit less traditional in terms of, you know, bylines and mixing opinion with news content, you know, although I think that's getting better. But like, you know, so these really big elements of journalism in Chicago, nobody's talking about them. Why aren't they? It's because it doesn't serve their interests. You know, they're not really journalists. They're not really interested in local news. They're interested in their foundations and, you know, getting money for their next program and that sort of stuff. So there's this big disconnect going on, in my opinion.
Are you optimistic overall going forward? Because you and I have talked about here some pretty serious issues and some things that maybe aren't so great and some critiques of the local journalism community. But are you excited about anything going forward?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm excited about, you know, what we're doing, and I'm excited about the opportunity in local news. You know, everybody talks about how we have huge local news deserts and local news is dead. And that's a massive problem. And we do have all of those things. But that also means there's a tremendous market opportunity. No one is telling the stories of these neighborhoods or offering advertising space that could run alongside it. People are vastly underserved and people want, you know, reliable news that they can count on and that's useful. I think people still want the news. But I think that, you know, if you're working with companies like Google, that put you at a disadvantage already. And if you don't think strategically about like what your product is and how what you're selling is truth and the currency of it is trust, you know, then you're going to compromise your business. You know, they've lost the plot as to what our business is. And I think there's a huge, it's because of that, it allows real journalists and real journalism to stand out and to deliver vital, wanted, valuable news to people and hopefully make a living doing it. I mean, that's our goal. I'm trying to make a living as a neighborhood journalist and getting closer and closer by the day. Yeah, well, you know, a lot of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, hey, hats off to you, Justin. I mean, I know this is a lot of work. There's a lot to think about in the context of everything else that's going on here. And yeah, there's a lot that we've talked about right now with Google and the state of journalism and where this is all headed. And I know that we'll continue to talk about this as you continue your work at McKinleyPark.news. That's the website for the McKinley Park News. That is a local news organization covering the McKinley Park neighborhood in Chicago. Justin Kerr is the publisher of that organization. Justin, as always, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the chance to talk and, you know, rarely get a chance to geek out like this. But this is tons of fun. Thank you so much.
In the Chicago Reader, you will see the column The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Guilty, guilty like your cologne makes you ache and feel guilty as hell.
Oh, yes. Once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of one Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip, in the Chicago Reader and music historian himself. And Steve, this week, this is kind of it's a little bit of a special after-school edition of The Secret History of Chicago Music, a very special episode where this is partly like your travel chronicles, also giving some nod to a really cool musician, Joe Cassidy of Butterfly Child from here in Chicago, and recognizing other musicians around the world. Did I kind of capture everything? Is that pretty much it?
This is a hard one to capture everything, I gotta say. We've been struggling, like, what's the lead photo gonna be for this story? You know, how could one photo sort of encapsulate this whole thing? And then there was talk of me drawing something secret history style for a minute. But yeah, this was sort of more a kind of a special article I did in place of secret history this week, but with definite ties to secret history of Chicago music, because I wrote up, yeah, when Joe Cassidy passed away a few years ago, I wrote him up. He really was part of the secret history of Chicago music. He was this amazing, you know, guy from Belfast who moved here in the early aughts and sort of like made this his town, produced a million bands, started a million bands, encouraged a million bands. And clearly I looked up to him. He was a friend. He produced a few albums for my band. So I made no bones from the beginning that this was going to be personal. And when I wrote up after he passed in 2021, and this is almost like a follow-up in a way, because Joe, being sort of the magical guy that he was, there's a legacy and a continuing sort of influence and a continuing thing just around him that has gone on since he's left this mortal sphere.
Yeah, and we started off the segment hearing some music from Joe Cassidy, and it's interesting here because, like you say, I remember playing Butterfly Child when I was at Loyola at my college radio station, WLUW. I feel like I say that a lot because we were playing good music, and this was certainly that. So he died at the age of 51 in 2021. You were friends with him. And you got to travel last month to where he's from in Northern Ireland. And you were a part of a panel this is so cool. You were giving out some awards kind of in his honor, weren't you?
Yeah, man, this is intense. Okay, first of all, I got to say, college radio in the 90s kicked butt.
Totally. Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to just be an old man, Gen Xer, and just say, that's when I came up in it, and it was such a cool, diverse thing, and you're getting imports from overseas, like Joe, who Cassidy, aka Butterfly Child in those days, who, yeah, he recorded for several, like, cool labels, Dedicated, these stuff that I just was like, oh yeah, I just pretty much buy about anything off this label, because it's always some cool, dreamy, sort of on the vanguard of, you know, rock music, you know, at the time. It's just, I feel like, yeah, college rock, indie rock, whatever you want to call it. And yeah, Joe was there for those sort of golden days of that. So, when he passed, there was a big sort of tribute in his honor at the Metro. Mm-hmm. And a lot of his friends, bands he produced, he had another band called Assassins that were going to be a huge big deal. And then that major label BS that always happens got to them. And so it ended up sort of being a benefit, because his sister, Frances Macklin, formerly Cassidy, back in Belfast, she was putting together a sort of award, you know, in his name to maybe sort of give to a new musician, you know, coming up, because Joe, like, managed bands and encouraged, you know, so many people, and she thought it would just be a good way to preserve his legacy. And she sort of started talking to someone at this place called the Oh Yeah Center in Belfast, which I got to go to. Is amazing. It's like cool venue with like a museum of like old posters of Thin Lizzy and them and stuff that you can like check out. I'm like, this is my dream, you know. Yeah. We don't have this. I don't think people would be respectful enough. They'd probably smash the glass here and take the stuff, you know. at a venue. No, but this is a respectable, you know, sort of like museum. But anyways, so the money basically from this Metro event ended up going for this awards, and then every year in Belfast, they have this thing called the Northern Ireland Music Prize, and they say prize kind of like we say award show. So it's this big event. It's not one prize. It's many going to bands for like best live band. And so, yeah, I got invited to basically come over as a journalist and cover this thing and see this part of the process. And I'm also at the same time on the board of people deciding who this band is going to be that's going to win the award, because I was sort of in Joe's orbit and I played at that Metro show. So it's very crazy to get sort of all angles and the whole genesis of this thing, you know, if that makes sense. It's a complicated thing, but it's sort of a beautiful, simple thing too.
And so you got to go to Northern Ireland, and you are now sitting in judgment as a judge, as someone who's taking a look at these bands. And so there were for you a few awards that you were able to give out here, right? So you awarded some prizes to a couple bands.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I got to explain a little bit here too, because no, I wasn't personally handing any awards to anyone.
Right.
It was sort of clear that this band Arborist was the favorite, and yeah, it's a really cool record. They sort of have a little, someone said Neil Young meets Radiohead. And then I think I said in my thing, Lamb Chop meets Talk Talk.
But, yeah.
You know, but because it has this sort of spacey texture thing, but there's an Americana rootsy thing. It was actually recorded in Virginia. I could see how it was like something new, and that could sort of almost, you know, put the Belfast scene on the map a bit. And yeah, we kind of agreed that was the winner.
Go ahead, go ahead.
That's really cool. You know, you going over to Ireland, Northern Ireland, and you participating in this, and also thinking about the history that you have with Joe Cassidy. He came over to Chicago from that area. Butterfly Child, Assassins, did a lot of great work for so many people, especially musicians here in Chicago and beyond. And you say something at the end of your piece, which I think is really cool. You say that Joe Cassidy got by for years with music as his sole source of income. And he actually inspired you to do that hustle and to go freelance and to kind of do the same thing. And as you acknowledge, it's been hard, but he really inspired you to do that. So I think that that's a message that maybe some other folks need to hear, that, hey, if you've got these dreams, these passions of sorts, go ahead and pursue those. It's really worth it, isn't it?
It is. You really never know what's going to happen. And the band that actually got the award, the Chrysalis Award, this band Chalk from Belfast, they've been around like a year or two. There's like, they've totally sort of accumulated, just, you know, from the ground up, sort of got this following. There was very apparent, you know, like when I saw them, they had their thing down, this sort of like heavy, sort of somewhere between sort of electronica and goth and a little bit of like punky aggro sort of like release in it. And Joe loved that kind of stuff too, and there was a little bit of it in Assassins. But now they just, you know, got this award too to sort of encourage them. And I actually just heard from Joe's sister Frances, who was so awesome in making this all happen, and the Ireland Board of Tourism, got to give them a shout for making this happen too. They are going to use the money that they won from this award to come over to the States and like tour over here and do like South by Southwest and do all that stuff. So there's like even a sort of final poetic justice in that they get to come to America now, you know, which Joe did a long time ago and sort of made his home. I don't know if they'll get to Chicago on this trip, but they're, you know, they're going to make that big ambitious let's see if we can, you know, make a splash in the States thing, which is a big deal over there, you know, and not to romanticize America at all, per se. But, you know, I think it shows they're serious to sort of get out of your village wherever you are and sort of like, you know, take it further, you know.
This is a really cool story. I'm glad you had a chance to go overseas and especially a chance to write this special piece, very special episode of The Secret History of Chicago Music. You can check it out online, chicagoreader.com, and in the hard copy of The Reader, which, of course, you can pick up all over the place. Steve Krakow is the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in The Reader and a music historian. Steve, thank you, as always, for talking to us. And how about we go out on some chalk to hear the next generation of tunes?
Totally. Let's do it. And I'll get my hype in before we sign off here. Secret History of Chicago Music concert series at the Hideout, Saturday, December 16th.
Be there.
Be there, be square, and enjoy this rock out to up-and-comers from Belfast, Chalk.
And that does it. Outside the Loop show number 895 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. You are the greatest. So is Bob Ferguson. He's our engineer in the WGN radio studio. So thanks to Ferg. And I hope you have a wonderful week. Come on back next time, right here on Outside the Loop.